Welcome on to the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, where our long national nightmare is almost over. The finals are upon us, finally. And I'm joined by Danny LaRue. How did you keep yourself busy during the long dead period, other than simply recording podcasts over and over again?
Are you really going to force me to admit how much Game of Thrones I've watched recently?
Yes, I am.
I had never seen any of it before, and it nothing's definite yet, but it looks like I'll probably be somewhere deep in the fourth season by the time we get there. And I hadn't seen anything before the Warriors closed out the Rockets about a week ago.
Yeah, and it was really a shame, too, because I knew he was watching it, and he watched Season 3, Episode 9, which, you know, since we won't spoil it for you guys, but something happens in that episode. And I was hoping to get his reaction afterwards, but then I realized there's probably some people who haven't watched it yet. So
yeah.
Why don't we talk about basketball? That's what you're listening to this podcast for. Is nigh on the time that we have to make our finals predictions, official finals predictions. I will let you go first.
So I feel weird picking for a road team to close it out, but I think the Warriors win this in six games. I think that home court advantage, while both teams have done very well at home this year, I don't think it means a ton with these teams. I think their ceilings are high enough that where they win won't matter as much. And I think the Cavs are definitely good enough to win at least two games in this series. So Warriors in six is just where I turned out.
Yeah, if it were the old 2-3-2 format, I would absolutely be all over Warriors six. I actually think that this Cavs team gives me some pause, and as I've said a few times before, I think they can muck things up. There are some things about them with LeBron, with the offensive rebounding, that can be a difficult matchup. I expect the Warriors to kind of figure things out as the series goes along, but I am still going to go Warriors in seven, but I anticipate that it'll be more along the lines of, you know, the least close seven-game series that you can imagine. Maybe akin to that first round series in 2008 between the Celtics and the Hawks, where the Celtics just blew out the Hawks in all of their wins, but the Hawks were able to scrape together some games at home. And so it made the series seem a lot closer than it actually was. So yeah, that's my pick. I'm going to go Warriors in seven. And since we are actually tied right now, each of us has gotten every series correct except for one. This can be the tiebreaker, whoever gets this closest.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of doing it. And another thing that's been, I haven't changed my pick, but the injury news, I would say, on the aggregate of what has happened in the last week has helped the Warriors, because Klay Thompson has been cleared to play. And one of the news pieces of today is that Kyrie Irving has said that he's still not right.
Yeah, and he looked okay in that game four. We'll see how he turns out. This may be a little bit of sandbagging by Cleveland. There's been some speculation that that's the case, or they're just being open and upfront with the injuries, and Kyrie is just such a warrior, and he's going to fight through it. And I shouldn't say that so sarcastically, because I've actually had that injury, and it's pretty rough to try and deal with. But yeah, I think that's certainly the fact that it looks like, at least from all we've heard, he's not going to be totally healthy. That would indicate that you're six-game prediction might be a little more accurate. I mean, I guess I will say this. You have the advantage here, because I think that it is much more likely that the Warriors win in five than that the Cavs win the series. So in some ways, just from a game theory perspective, I probably didn't make the right pick if I'm trying to win our little competition here.
But we did make our picks independently, so I think at least I think we did. So that helps.
Yeah, no, we've been sort of batting this back and forth for a while. I would never insinuate any malfeasance on your part for that. So that's anything else that you haven't had a chance to say about the series? I'm kind of previewed out, you know, because I had the Mahoney and Pelton podcast, but we haven't had a chance to talk about this series all that much between the two of us.
The only thing I'll say is I talked about this a little bit with Seth Partno on the Real Jam Radio podcast.
Yeah, listen to that, by the way.
Well, thank you. Is that I one of my kind of philosophies that I've had trouble articulating for a little bit is that I feel like basketball is about the choices that you make your opponent make. And so that's, you know, how you close, how you cover, how you do things like that. And both of these teams
You lost me.
And both of these teams have players that make that really challenging. And I feel like the Warriors just have more counters to those problems than the Cavs do, because partially because that's due to injury. You know, they don't have Kevin Love, and they and the Cavs don't have the depth. So I'm really excited just from a basketball standpoint to see how these two very disparate teams work together and make a series.
The one thing I haven't said yet is I think that we will see a little bit of a reprise of the strategy against the Hawks and, to a lesser extent, the Bulls that was employed by Cleveland, where they're going to try and make the lesser three-point shooters just beat them, even if they're wide open. I think Draymond Green is a prime candidate for that strategy, where we may see Cleveland try to blitz pick and rolls with Steph a little bit more and just leave Draymond Green open. I think he's shooting under 25% on threes in the playoffs. Is that right?
I don't have it offhand, but that sounds. Yeah, I know it's low.
So, and Draymond is a guy who can get hot, certainly, but also someone who can struggle at times. And I think they may at least make him prove that he can get hot against them. And he was actually 0 for 10 against them in those two regular season games as well. So maybe that'll be kind of where Cleveland starts, and they're going to make Golden State pay if Green can't hit those shots.
Yeah, that's definitely something to watch. Also, how Blatt decides to start and finish games defensively, where he puts Kyrie, and something you and I talked about a little bit before, but I'm very high on, is the idea of playing Dellavedova more against the starters and Kyrie more against the backups, just shading their minutes one way versus the other.
Yeah, all right. So what we're going to talk about here, I guess I should have gotten to this first, since there's not that much left finals preview-wise. We're going to get into the Knicks offseason in some of the same fashion that we did with the Heat and the Lakers over the last 2 days, and also get into a little news. Let's do that right now. Leading off with Mike D'Antoni interviewing in Denver, apparently, or not in Denver, but with Denver, with GM Tim Connelly.
I'm really excited about the possibility of another super up-tempo team in Denver. They have such a huge home court advantage because of the altitude, and if they play at tempo there, it's an even larger advantage, assuming their players don't pass out in practice or on the court. So I think that's a great fit. I think that Denver should play up-tempo all the time. I think that's just something they should do. And D'Antoni obviously does that better than most. And I like the fit with him and Ty Lawson. I'm not sure Ty Lawson is definitely a piece of their future, but I think that would use him very well and probably make him happy.
It would be interesting to see what happens there, because they made a big commitment with Kenneth Faried. He, as a four-man, does not really seem to fit D'Antoni's style much, although they did play with him as a four-man when D'Antoni was coaching with Team USA, so maybe that's something that he could use a little bit more, and getting up and down does play to Farid's strengths, but not really a shooter. D'Antoni, not a big guy on post-ups. He's said before that the numbers don't really favor posting up unless you have just like a total monster, and that's kind of where the growth in Farid's game has been over the last 2 years, the extent it's happened. So, yeah, I think it might make Farid, whose big extension for $12 million a year is kicking in this year, someone that they may try and move. Not someone who you necessarily think of as an upper echelon starter at power forward. Maybe he's someone who could be a little bit better as a center coming off the bench in small lineups for D'Antoni, but you know, paying $12 million a year for that, not something you necessarily want to do. He's a little bit older too, probably doesn't have as much room to grow as some of the younger guys since he came out later in his college career. So considering all that, definitely might expect to see some movement from him. I think it will be great for Danilo Gallinari. He's someone who can thrive as a small ball four. Quietly started to get his game back. He had that 40-point game, I think, against the Mavericks as the season wound down. So he's someone who I think you can look to have a breakout year if they were to hire D'Antoni. But that's obviously not necessarily going to happen yet. They just interviewed him. But I like him better than another candidate they interviewed, Mike Woodson.
Yeah, Mike Woodson, it surprised me. It was something that I hadn't heard until recently, and I never thought of the job that he did with the Knicks as particularly strong, and the track record.
Well, hold on, but sorry to interrupt you, but
go ahead.
I mean, he did get a team that was fairly limited to, I think it was 54 wins.
That's true.
In the 2013 season, so Maybe are we giving him short shrift? I don't think so, but you know, maybe we are.
Yeah, we definitely could be. When I watched the Knicks, I didn't think, wow, this is a really well-coached team. I thought they did outperform expectations, and that's always another sign as well, but that can be underestimating talent, though, as they've done the last couple, you know, since then, maybe we weren't underestimating their talent.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when you look at what they did in the years before and after that year, maybe then, you know, you would have to say he did well that year, but then again, you would have to say he didn't do as well the year after that. So, and I think even when they had success, it was kind of not the way he wanted to play. They had success with Carmelo at the four, shooting a lot of threes. They had one of the best offenses in the league as a result of that, and that was still something that he very reluctantly would go to.
Yeah, and something that we were both wondering about, just kind of thinking about, is how often a coach that didn't have great success at his first destination really made it work and became, let's say, in the top half of coaches later on in their coaching career.
Yeah, and I don't think Woodson was that bad.
No.
I mean, I think everything gets magnified in New York, and people were freaking out that they were disappointing last year in the 2014 season. And because of that, he may have gotten a worse rep than he deserved. I think he was, you know, about an average coach. But that's the thing. How many guys who are just kind of average end up going to another stop and then being solidly above average or really good? So one of the theories I have that's kind of evolving is maybe you should try a new coach rather than a retread, someone who has kind of demonstrated that he, you know, might be average, but really what you should be looking for, I think there's a lot of average coaches out there, and you should be trying to play the lottery and see if you can find someone who's solidly above average. And I don't think that Woodson really did anything in his previous two stops to make you feel like, all right, this guy is a really, really good coach. And I think the point of hiring a new coach is to try, it's a lottery ticket to try and find that guy who's going to be an amazing coach.
And that goes along with an idea that actually you articulated to me and I've adopted as a part of my own kind of philosophy on coaching, which is that there are very few net positives and there are very few strong net negatives in coaching, and there are a lot in the middle. And having one guy in the middle versus another guy in the middle doesn't really make that big a difference. And so I think that's an interesting idea. I'm still not all the way on board with it, but it's also true that with Woodson, you didn't see those flashes. Like, even there have been some coaches that had inauspicious beginnings, especially early in their career. George Karl was the first guy that came to mind for me. Also Doc Rivers. I later realized that Doc Rivers did much better in his first stop than I had remembered. But those are the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you could look at George Karl was a guy who he had a terrible stint in Cleveland, okay stint then in Golden State in the mid-80s, but then, they're on the way to winning like 20 games when he got fired, I think in the 87-88 season. But then he came on with the Sonics and really has excelled at every job he's had since then, you know, unless you're going to count last year's Kings. So he's one guy you might look at. Terry Stotts is another guy who had two stints. He had one in Atlanta and one in Milwaukee, neither of which was amazing. But then he spent a lot of time in Dallas. And so at least then you can kind of have an idea that he spent a lot of time there. He got more of an analytic bent. And I think he's been good in Portland, not unbelievable, but certainly, I mean, to get the defense out of him that they did, or for him to get the defense out of the team that he did in that first half of this year was pretty good. So, but still, I mean, he's not a guy that I would look at as amazing. And so I think D'Antoni has a very solid record of improving teams, getting them to play above their talent level. So I think he would be my pick over Woodson, although it is irony that, you know, Woodson is the guy who succeeded D'Antoni in New York.
Yeah, and I also think Melvin Hunt deserves heavy consideration. I thought the team played pretty well under him at the end of the season as well.
Yeah, you know, I think so too. And maybe because he's an interim guy, he's been there for a long time already, they feel like they need to go in a totally different direction. But yeah, they did start playing much better once he started as an interim role. Two other things we got to talk about before we get into the Knicks. One is there's a report from Amy Schwartz out of Portland that LaMarcus Aldridge's Portland home is for sale. She cautioned in her tweet, take it for what it's worth. Perhaps we should do so. But another slightly troubling sign when you've had these reports from anonymous Blazer teammates saying there's a 50% chance they thought that he would leave. Certainly some very attractive options for him to go to in Texas if he decides to move on from Portland. But he's also in a situation where, at almost 30 years of age, getting a fifth year from Portland might be important to him as well.
It certainly could be, and I wrote a piece on the Sporting News last week about his unusual contract circumstance, that him waiting a year to try to get his maximum would give him a lot of raise. And one of the points that somebody brought up on Twitter, I'd give them credit if I remember who it was, is that he's not probably going to be able to get that next year. And I agree with that. I mean, the article was more of the thought experiment and why it was interesting than saying,
well,
hey.
So hold on. Why do you think he wouldn't be able to get that next year?
Well, at that point, I believe he'll be 31. And the supermax for him, because at that point he'll have had 9 years, will be substantial. I think 27 to 29 is the range that's in my brain right now. And that, for a 5-year deal, let's say you're the Blazers, would be a lot. You know, if you can do something maybe similar to that or start at that range and go flat or go down, I think that's a lot more palatable. But when you're thinking about that, also you're 1 year closer to Damian Lillard getting paid. It would be hard for Portland, though. At the same time, they're in a different situation because while it's a nice place to live and everything like that, they're not in a situation like New York or LA where their cap space is so valuable, and it's not like they would have a ton anyway.
Yeah, and they do have an owner who is willing to spend.
Certainly.
Asked in Paul Allen, the Blazers paid the luxury tax in the very early years under the system when they had some of those teams with Rasheed Wallace and Scottie Pippen and those guys. So, you know, maybe Allen is willing to do that. I mean, Aldridge's guy has been an all-star the last 4 years. And Aldridge will be actually 30 in July, so 31 next summer. Yeah, it's interesting to see whether it would be a risk for him if he wanted to do the whole one-year deal and then with a second-year player option and then opt out again at 31. I think that players who are that age generally probably have a higher opinion of themselves than we might. He did show some signs of slippage this year, had a really bad playoffs, obviously was dealing with an injury as well. So that's certainly a very interesting situation. Maybe he re-ups there for one more year, does that 1 year with the second-year player option, or maybe he says, all right, this is the time when San Antonio has space. They're usually not going to have space, so I'll give it a shot going there. I do imagine that anywhere he does go, he would want to go somewhere where he has a better chance to win than in Portland. I wouldn't say that Dallas is that. Maybe you could say that Houston is if they can move around a lot of salary, but given his experience level, his salary is going to be pretty high, so it might be really tough for them to fit him in. But just not a great sign for LaMarcus. We'll get into him much more during free agency, but for Portland retaining him, you know, maybe he's just moving into a new place, who knows, but just another little bit more smoke there than we've seen so far.
Yeah, definitely true. And there was one other piece of news, right?
Yeah, Tim McMahon at ESPN Dallas reported that Chandler Parsons is confident that he'll be back at the start of next season. Still no word on precisely what that surgery was. But, you know, it sounds like it was more than just your normal meniscus trim type of thing at the very least, because then you wouldn't even be talking about there being a question of him being back. So I think it's going to be reasonable to expect him at the very least to take some time to get up to speed at the start of next season.
Yeah, and that is always a thing that you have to consider when you're thinking about how a team is going to start, especially with how competitive the Western Conference is going to be in the playoff picture next year.
All right, well, let's move on now to the New York Knicks cap situation. Somewhat spiritual brothers of the Lakers in quite a few respects. They have a big star who's making lots of money that wasn't, you know, missed much of the year last year. They both have a connection to Phil Jackson, and they both have encumbered future draft picks in 2016, so it doesn't really make much sense for them to be bad next year.
Yeah, they have a lot of parallels. The one big difference is something that happened last summer that we didn't put it. I mean, I wrote about it, I cared about it, but it was the addition of Jose Calderon, who has 2 more years at about $7.5 million. It's a little under that in 2015-16, a little over that. It's conceptually possible to move it, but it's definitely not an asset at this point. And when you're a team that's struggling to have one max slot, granted they might not be able to use it, but that's in that kind of realm, that money would be very useful for them.
Yeah, and we recall that they took on that salary. They were able to dump Raymond Felton in that trade, and he makes about $4 million. So they took on basically another $3 million for this year, but then Calderon's contract actually goes one more year at $7 million than Felton's did. So they took on another $7 million for the 2016-17 season, in addition to this season. And of course, they gave up Tyson Chandler as well. I would actually argue that that ultimately turned out better for the franchise because they managed to get a top four pick, which they probably wouldn't have if Chandler were still around, although they might have been able to trade him for more later in the year. So I think it worked out all right, perhaps not intentionally. I would definitely say that they were not the winners in that trade, at least from a basketball standpoint, but maybe with the long-term health of the franchise, getting that draft pick will be a little bit better for them.
One thing that I'll note on the Knicks that makes them particularly, I would say, interesting in a sense, is that they have a series of guys that have large cap holds that were on the team for big salaries, Bargnani, Shved, Jason Smith. I personally wouldn't expect any of them to come back, which means that you don't have to worry about the dance that teams like the Lakers and a couple other squads, the Rockets or another team like this, have to make decisions on those guys. They're all so prohibitive that I wouldn't expect them to be back. So you can just kind of take each player, and it's a much easier decision than it is for some other teams.
Yeah, you mentioned Bargnani, and at some point you posed a question on Twitter of what some of the worst trades were of the last decade and a half. We'll have to do a whole podcast on that at some point, but certainly trading a 2016 first-round pick for the right to get 2 years of Bargnani and his massively overpaid salary these last 2 years would have to go right up there among some of the worst trades. And they also, so to put a bow on what they have to do with their draft pick, first of all, there is a pick swap with Denver from the Carmelo Anthony trade. And then that swapped pick they owe to the Raptors.
Right.
So there's basically, you know, they're going to give up their pick either way. It doesn't help them at all to be bad this year. So, I mean, I think they're going to try and go for it. It's just a question now of how much do you want to encumber 2016 when you could again have a ton of space. So let's go through their roster here. If you want, tell us what everyone's making right now among the guys they might actually still have on the team.
Sure. So the high budget items, Carmelo Anthony is making a little under $23 million next year. Calderon's making.
Yeah, and he did, and sorry to interrupt, but he did take a little bit less this year.
Yep.
To help out and give them a little bit more space. He could have gotten a higher raise and didn't. He does get his full raise for next year, but so he could have been making almost $24 million this year around there. So saved him about $1 million in cap space they're going to have the ability to use now.
Yeah, so they have him at that price. Then they have Calderon at a little under 7.5. Then the only other locked-in contract they have is they picked up Tim Hardaway Jr.'s option. So he's cheap. He's, you know, a little under $1.5 million. And so then they have three guys that they have decisions on, all under $1 million, Cleanthony Early, Langston Galloway, and Ricky Lito. The first two are automatic yeses. There's not even a question there. Lito, I would guess that they decline it and maybe consider bringing him back on a summer league deal. They had him it was one of those contracts that are getting more prevalent. I'm a big supporter of them if teams can pull it off, which is signing a guy at the very end of the year and getting an option for the next year, because then you get a better chance to look at them, and at a cheap price. So that, and then they have restricted ability on Travis Ware and I believe Quincy Acey too,
and Shved as well, but his qualifying offer is so big
they'll renounce him. So
I would guess that they will not make him a qualifying offer and tie up their space that way. So, and then they're also going to have a cap hold for their 2015 first rounder, number 4 overall, for $3.3 million. So you throw that in, and then also a concept we haven't discussed yet on the podcast is if you have less than 12 players. For every spot that's not filled, and when I say players, it's either someone who's under contract, someone that you have a cap hold for who finished the season on your roster and has not been renounced yet, or a first-round draft pick that is unsigned. So if you have any spots other than people that fall into that category, then there's a cap hold for the rookie minimum, and that's $525,000 next year. So basically, an easy way to think about it is, when you consider the number of roster slots. You know, for every two roster slots, that's going to be about $1 million. For every two open roster slots, that is, going to be about another $1 million that's encumbered. So when you consider all of that, you get them to about, I think, $27 million in potential space. I think that's their, that's the most that they can get to here, $26-27 million or so. One option that they might have is to stretch Jose Calderon. And by doing that, if they do that before September 1st, there's 2 years left on his contract, totals about $15 million. So you would then spread that over double the number of years left on the contract plus one. So that's 5 years. It would be about $3 million a year, going all the way into the 2019 season. But then you're only counting him for $3 million this year and $3 million next year instead of the $7.5 million or so. So you're opening up another $4 million in space, $4.5 million in space the next two summers by stretching him. They may decide that they want to do that, if they can't move on from him in some fashion through a trade that's, not too punitive.
And the beauty of the NBA structure is that they don't have to make that decision blind. They can wait to see how things go, and if it's necessary, then they can do it, and if it's not, then they can bring him, then they can keep him on.
Yeah, no, that's right. And they have until September 1st to do that. So if they have a guy that they feel like they really want to bring in, or multiple guys they really want to bring in that they can only do by stretching him, they can do that pretty much at their leisure. So that's then you've got, if you go on to the next year, let's say you were to stretch Calderon, then you could have, assuming you don't encumber 2016 space with additional guys that you sign in 2015, you could have, you know, as much as about $47 million in room, maybe even more than that, maybe even $50 million. But I think they're going to try to encumber that space and get you know, maybe one or two guys in there, someone, either a max guy and then another good guy, or maybe two kind of, you know, mid-level guys.
Yeah, I definitely think that they have more pressure to do that. And also, unlike some other teams that are going into 2016, they don't have a ton of guys who they're going to want to retain that already on their books that will be making more money. Langston Galloway will be a restricted free agent, but he has a really low cap hold, and that's something that we dealt with Chandler Parsons, is that teams can really use that to their advantage if they want to. And New York is specifically a team that if they want to spend that summer, they can do that. They can use the moratorium and the 3 days of that, if they want to make him the last piece.
All right, well, so who do you think they realistically could get with this, you know, between $26 million or maybe even as much as $30 million in space if they are to stretch Calderon?
If I don't know what DeAndre Jordan wants. If he wants to live in New York for whatever reason, he's definitely an option. Just off instinct, I don't have any insight knowledge. I don't think they have a great shot at Lover Aldridge this year. So that gets you to a narrower pool. I don't see them pulling one of the restricted free agents. I think that, like I said, with the Lakers, they can make that offer. You know, if Jimmy Butler or whoever wants to sign their qualifying offer with them, they can do that if they haven't gotten anybody else. I don't have a ton of guys in that mid-range that I really love yet. Yeah, that certainly will happen. There are always guys that fall through the cracks a little bit. I think about somebody like Paul Millsap. That does happen. But the Knicks have such a high value to their cap space. I feel that they can almost always do better, and it always frustrates me when the big markets aim a little bit lower.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of ideas here. One is obviously to go for the big fish, Aldridge or Love. I don't see, again, it's the same problem with the Lakers, where, and the Lakers at least maybe have a little bit more young talent with that number two pick and Randall, although I think Carmelo is better than anyone that the Lakers have on their roster right now by far. So maybe you could say they're more desirable, especially in the East. But still, I don't see any circumstance under which this team becomes a contender or even a home court advantage team in the East next year, no matter who they sign. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to, you kind of feel like you have to use an any chance rule with the East, considering how rough that conference was this year, but it would be monumental.
Yeah, so I think one strategy is you just try and convince someone like Love or Aldridge to come there and sign a big deal for a long time, But, you know, you've got a couple options after that, assuming those guys don't want to come. You could go kind of the Greg Monroe type of tier, max him out. You know, I mean, I think doing that, he would be a nice fit for the triangle offensively. But again, probably not someone who's worth it, frankly, considering his defensive limitations. Well, it depends on who they draft too. I think, you know, if they get one of the guards, then they'll probably go for a big. If they get someone who, if they trade the pick, then that obviously would change things as well. I wouldn't advocate them doing that, because rookie contracts are so incredibly valuable. And then if they, you know, say Okafor somehow falls to them, or they decide to go with Porzingis, or even there's been talk of Willie Cauley-Stein as well, then maybe they're going to try and get, someone who's more of a playmaker, but, not really the greatest free agent point guard group here. Dragic, as we assume, is going to re-sign in Miami, and there's not a ton beyond him. And, also, you know, guys who are good fits for the triangle who can shoot it, not all over the place, at least among the guys you might consider, upper echelon. So it is nice, a good group of wing players this year, guys like Danny Green, Damari Carroll, you know, Jay Crowder as a restricted free agent is another guy who I think, might be a pretty decent fit. So those type of guys, but again, you're going to have to overpay like crazy, I think, to get someone like that.
Yeah, unless you get somebody who's in love with playing in New York. And that is a possibility, but you can't bank on that. That's not, you know, when you're building a team, you can't be like, hey, we're going to get one of those guys.
Yeah, you know, this is the thing, right? New York is always considered this, like, amazing free agent destination. Who has ever really wanted to go there so badly other than Carmelo? You know, when have the Knicks ever, like, really gotten the big fish in free agency?
Amare doesn't count. I mean, they paid him more money, and they didn't insure his contract. So,
well, I mean, it wasn't. I mean, his contract was uninsurable.
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
the decision not to insure him, but yeah.
Fair point.
Yeah, I think they. Yeah, the Knicks probably offered him more than anyone else would have, or at least in terms of a longer contract than anyone else would have in that 2010 offseason.
Yeah, it's hard to think about. And then there was a stretch in that they didn't have a ton of, like, real space to work with. But you're right that they haven't pulled those players. It's not like the Lakers where you can think of examples where they actually used it.
Yeah, I mean, there's no examples of, like, Karl Malone and Gary Payton going to play for the Knicks for well below their market value like those guys did in 03, 04. So, yeah, I think my ultimate strategy probably for the Knicks, if you can't get one of the best guys, would be to say, okay, you know, we don't have our draft pick this year. How about we just try to maintain flexibility, get guys in on one-year deals with the idea that, hey, you're going to want to be a free agent again next year with the cap going up. We will overpay you, but only for this 1 year. And then if it really works out with them, they can bring that person back. Or they can just have a ton of space, really, in that, you know, almost $50 million potentially in that 2016 offseason when the cap's going up to $89 million. So I think that would ultimately be my strategy. We'll see, though, you know, how much pressure there is for them to get better this year. And Phil, you know, supposedly also this has been some weird reporting, by the way. People saying, like, oh, he can opt out of his contract at the end of the year. I mean, why would he do that? He's making like $12 million a year. I can't imagine why he would want to do that. So I think I see him staying on and getting paid rather than opting out of his own contract to cost himself $36 million.
Especially when I don't think he has an itch to, like, go on the sidelines or something again. You know, that you would give that up for the right opportunity, but what is the right opportunity for Phil Jackson? What do you get the guy who has everything?
Yeah, and I think he just physically, the idea is that he can't really do that.
Yeah, exactly. So. And one other thing to think about with the Knicks that I wish I'd brought up with the Lakers is that you never think about these teams as being receptacles for bad contracts because you think, oh, they can do more with it. But there really aren't that many within the narrow window of what a team like the Lakers or Knicks would want. Of, you would want somebody who's on an expiring contract. So basically the idea would be, let's say you're a team that's on the fringes of cap space, to say, hey, you have $10 million salary of a guy you don't want. You can give him to us. Maybe you give us some assets back or however, depending on the quality of player and everything. And we'll take them. That's what Utah did. That's how Utah, when the Warriors wanted Andre Iguodala, they took back Andres Bjelland and Richard Jefferson. The Knicks could be an option for that if they really strike out, But there aren't really that many players that fit that bill.
No, there aren't, because so many contracts are shorter now. I mean, other than people who play for the Brooklyn Nets, it's hard to think of anyone who is still kind of a productive player, yet is also wildly overpaid and has a really long contract. So, and the other problem there, too, I mean, another option that they might have would be if they move that number four pick. Well, the problem there is that you're basically then going to use your cap space on whoever you pick up for trading that number four pick, because presumably that's going to be for a more established player, someone that teams are afraid they might lose in 2016 anyway. And so you're using your cap space, and you know, you don't want to sacrifice both the draft pick and your cap space by making that trade. The only thing you might try and do is look for someone who's going to be a free agent next summer who's on a rookie deal, but anyone like that, teams are just going to try and keep them anyway if they're any good.
Yeah. Not saying that it's been proposed or anything like that, but if you were whoever the decision maker is in Sacramento and the Knicks offered you the fourth pick for DeMarcus Cousins, would you hang up the phone, and how quickly?
Yeah, I would not listen to that. No, I think that if you look at what Cousins is, I think he's a top 10 player in this league very clearly. He also, is, with the contract that he's on and the cap going up, is going to be quite a bargain. So not only is he a great player, but he's making way less than he's worth. So when you consider that, that vastly exceeds your expected output for the number four pick. I don't think there's anything that the Knicks could offer me on their entire roster and all of their draft pick assets that would make me surrender Cousins, quite frankly.
We're on the same page, but at the same time, you never know. Like it's one of those situations where I think I might value him a little more highly than their front office, but we'll find out if something actually happens.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I'm not sure. I think that they do still think highly of him. I mean, they gave him that maximum extension really when people were saying it might not be that great of an idea that you should make him prove it over another year. And I think that we criticize them a lot, but I think that that decision by them was a pretty good one, because he has improved quite a bit, and maybe, you know, just from a fit standpoint, he has felt better about that and, being under contract and having that commitment, and that's enabled him to play better and really reach superstar level over these last 2 years. Though, you know, not to say he's a peach to deal with by any means, but, you know, I think he's at least a little better than he was.
Sure, and I was one of those people who criticized it just for the timing of it. I'm somebody who feels like you to maximize it. But at the same point, the human element is very important, especially with DeMarcus Cousins, that it showed that the organization values him. And I felt like he was going to end up with that contract anyway. So it was more just an issue of tactics of, you know, what if everything blows up in your face? But he's earned it. Absolutely, he has earned it. And he's a great player in this league that I feel is underappreciated because he has never been on a winning team, but I don't remotely put that at his feet. So I hope he ends up on a great team, whether that's, I hope it's in Sacramento, if it's somewhere else, it's somewhere else, but he is so much fun to watch, and he cares a lot, and he's a unique player in this league. I really do think that.
I actually don't think he's that fun to watch. I think he's really good. He kind of gets fouled a lot. He's got some skills, but, likes to complain a lot. I totally respect his ability. I think he's a great, great player, but just from a purely aesthetic point, not one of the guys that I particularly enjoy watching that much. But now we're kind of beginning to ramble. Anything else you want to say about the Knicks before we wrap this up and, officially end the pre-finals dead period?
No, I think that the Knicks don't have a lot of real, low-risk guys on their team, which is one really big flaw when you're a team that you know is going to have some cap issues. You want to and that's another option for them this summer, is just to do what the Sixers do and take a ton of flyers at these guys for, you know, like $1 million or $2 million with non-guaranteed or whatever for a couple years. And if any of them work, that's awesome. You get a rotation player for really cheap. If they don't work, you probably weren't going to get much value out of that spot anyway.
Yeah, and even if they're able to get the type of free agents that they want, that's going to be, what, maybe three guys? And this is a team that has, with Carmelo basically as the only really established NBA player on the team. You might look at Langston Galloway, but you know, excuse me if I'm not going to fall all over fainting because he had a decent rookie season on what was a terrible team. I mean, he could turn out to be something, but I'm not ready to count on that yet. And so really, even if you spend that money, and then you might be able to get another real NBA player with the room exception, you're going to be a really, really shallow team. And, you know, with a guy like Carmelo who's coming off surgery and, you know, who knows who else they're going to get, but probably not necessarily someone with the greatest health record. If they're going to be someone that the Knicks are going to be able to get, there might be some health questions, and that's why they're available. So I think it's really, really hard for me to see this team getting much above a very low seed in the East, and I might even predict that they would be below that unless they get someone like Kevin Love or something. But he or maybe Aldridge are the only guys I think that out there that could even get them to that level.
Yeah, I think we're definitely on the same page there. Anything else that we want to talk about either with the Knicks or otherwise in the league?
No, I'm done. I'm done with finding other stuff to talk about other than the NBA Finals. I'm getting excited for it. There's a ton of great pieces out there that I was reading all day and getting fired up for. So let's move on to the NBA Finals. And, you know, we'll be recording tomorrow night, certainly on Sunday as well. Hope to have some guests on as well during the finals to wrap up those games. So please stay tuned for that. And we will be back, I think, tomorrow night. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Nate Duncan NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. You can Google the Dunked On podcast. Go to Real GM Basketball. We're on the front page there. You can find a link to subscribe on iTunes or XML with your favorite podcast player, including Dog Catcher with 2 G's. That's what I recommended yesterday. I guess it wasn't clear. A couple of people tweeted me. So, yeah, until next time, thanks a lot for listening. And we will be back with a much more focused podcast recapping game 1 of the NBA Finals tomorrow night.